Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 490.
Stand-up jokes are happening by me in New York, May 1st, 2nd, 3rd, Caroline's. Caroline's Comedy Club, which is where I performed the last time I was in New York. It's a good club. Plenty of room for people like you to come out to it. So please do that. Caroline's.com, Caroline's on Broadway. Come May 1st, 2nd, 3rd. I'll be there. Who knows? Maybe Chloe Dykstra will be there. I don't know.
This is all news to me.
This is a private conversation. I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry.
So, anyway, Chloe did this really crazy thing the other day. I'm going to tell you all about it. Would you please stop making noise? I'm trying to talk.
Sorry.
I'm trying to talk to the listener one-on-one. Sorry, guys. I'm going to come over here. Someone will not stop eavesdropping. Anyway, Chloe was really excited for me to tell you that the sponsor of this episode is Hover. Hover.com. New customers get 10% off with the promo code Bruce Gutter. I'm not kidding. I'm so excited about this promo code. I almost feel like we should be coming up with better promo codes for people to be like, just so they can use the promo code. But Bruce Gutter is, in fact, the promo code for Hover, which, by the way, Hover is a great way to secure a domain. If you want one, use Hover. No matter what, they don't really care what you want it for. They just want to help you secure it. It takes all the hassle and friction out of registering a domain. It's easy to use, powerful tools to manage your domain. Anyone can use it. But one of the best parts in this age of not being able to get a hold of customer service on the phone or being rifled through a bunch of menus is that there's a no wait, no hold, no transfer for phone service. No matter what happens when you're registering your domain, if you need some help, they're going to be there for you. So please, hover.com, they're experts at domains, and they're going to help you out and register your stuff online. 10% off using the promo code Bruce Gutter. That's B-R-U-C-E-G-U-T-T-E-R. Hover.com is the place. Register your domains. This podcast is William Catt, who I mean, I don't even know if I could express to you how much of a Greatest American Hero fan I am. I mean, he's done a bunch of other stuff. Yes, Carrie, bunch of other stuff. Perry Mason, million other things. And then recently, he's in a movie called Sparks, which comes out on Pi Day, March 14th. And go to sparksmovie.com to find out about that. But I am such a huge Greatest American Hero fan. I explained to him how I made the outfits. I made the Greatest American Hero outfits, and I'm positive it was awkward, but I don't care, because that's just how it is. I'm comfortable with that. So you should watch Greatest American Hero 2. I think it's on Netflix. I mean, after you watch Sparks movie, which comes out March 14th, but Greatest American Hero, I think it still totally holds up. William Catt, Robert Culp, Connie Selica, a bunch of kids who are teenagers that he's a teacher for, and some aliens, and a spacesuit that he's lost the instructions for. I will go on and on and on about it. So instead of doing that, I will simply play the Nerdist Podcast number 490 with William Catt.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hey,
I think we're recording.
We're good.
We're already recording.
This is it, man.
Oh, cool.
We've started. I know, right?
It's just like I didn't even get a chance to get nervous yet.
Pop quiz. Did you study?
I got my little cheat sheet.
Oh, cheat sheet for the Sparks movie.
Well, you know, you do so many. I do so many films and television shows over the year, and you figure there's like 75 to 100 people on every set.
Yeah.
You know, and a cast typically of at least 10 to 20. And so you try and remember all these names, and by the end of it, you know, you're talking about thousands and thousands of people. So, and we did this film a couple of, you know, like 18 months ago now, so it's like fresh. I've already forgotten these people. I don't even care about
them. Well, Clancy Brown is in it.
Yeah.
You must know Clancy Brown.
I do know
Clancy. But you do a lot of voiceover, too.
I've done some.
You've done superhero voiceover stuff.
I did some for Warner Brothers down there, but I don't know Clancy from there. I know Clancy. We both sat on the National Board of Directors for Screen Actors Guild.
Oh, right.
And tell me, that was fun. That was a lot of fun.
Those meetings must have been crazy.
Oh, my God. I used to tell my wife I'd rather sit home and bang my head with a hammer than go to another one of those meetings. I tell you, doing that, I don't know how the federal government gets anything done. Because you bring a motion to the floor, and then it goes back to a committee, then it goes to a subcommittee, and then it's got to come up through the ranks then it goes back to the floor, and then 9 times out of 10 it's voted down, so you got to go back and start all over again. I go, how does anything get done?
Most things don't. Most things do not get done.
Oh, my God.
That is why.
So it's kind of close to home, because nothing ever gets done in my family, even.
Well, you should not have a subcommittee in your family that then has to go and then convene and then come back and present it.
No, and my wife is the president, so
yes,
all
exactly.
decisions have to be run by her. And
it's probably just easier
has the
that
final.
Way. It's just easier that way.
Yeah.
If they had told you this before you came, you might have been scared. I have two versions of the Greatest American Hero suit.
Oh, wow.
One that I made and one that I purchased.
Wow.
Sadly, the one I purchased was
better. Now, why are you wearing, the audience can't see, but you're wearing a Green Lantern suit.
I'm not wearing a Green Lantern suit at all. What are you talking about? I'm wearing a shirt. Actually, the truth is I'm wearing a shirt about ants. This was from the California Academy of Sciences.
Very
Hello,
cool.
Kyle. Sit down, Kyle.
Yes, sir.
Nice. Kyle went around and got me a cup of coffee. I like that.
Good job, Kyle. You're a good man. But I'm a huge, 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 huge fan of that show.
Cool.
And watched it again on Netflix kind of recently, and it totally holds up.
It's remarkable, isn't it? Isn't it? You know, I'll tell you a very quick, strange story. Chris Foligno and I, who's the creator and the brains behind this, because it was originally a comic book, and we launched it and went to Comic-Con. With that and The Greatest American Hero, we did a small run of three books retelling the pilot and then some of The Greatest American Hero. And for that launch, we went to Comic-Con in 2008, and we brought Connie Selica and Bob Culp, late great Bob Culp. And the three of us got together, and we were having lunch, and we were just chatting and having a talk. And Connie grabs my arm. She says, "Oh, my God, it's still there. Do you feel it?" Because we immediately fell right back into those roles that we played so many years ago. And the chemistry was just lightning in a bottle. It was right there again.
It was such a fantastic – first of all, it was such a genius idea for a show.
Yeah.
And but the show only ran like two or three seasons, right?
No, it ran three seasons.
Three seasons, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So I always felt sort of cheated, like I wanted more. I wanted more of the story. And then you would sort of – they did a spinoff.
With a girl, yeah.
With a girl, yeah. Uh-huh. The Greatest American Heroine.
Yeah, yeah.
And you sort of passed off the suit to her in a way. But
it actually never went to air on television. It was only released in the DVDs when they did the release some years later. 5, 6 years ago, and they released it. Yeah,
I saw it on the internet because that's where everything happens now.
She looked good in tights. I got to tell you,
you look good in tights too, my friend. There was a young Bill Catt was a strapping, handsome young man. Let's not forget. Let's not forget Tommy Ross. Let's not forget Carrie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I
was quite fetching, wasn't I?
You're a fetching young man.
Yes, yes.
I'm pretty sure that having been like a rabid watcher of television, that you popped up on pretty much all of like the cop drama shows on the 70s.
Yeah, at the time I made the run as a young actor. I was doing a lot of theater, but I did all those shows that were going around at the time that all the young actors were going through on television. I worked with James Arness and worked with Clint Eastwood on Rawhide or Wagon Train or some such, you know. It's funny because Clint Howard, who's a friend, he and I talk about it because we all were kid actors at the time, you know. So we go back like 50 years, if I can say that. That's really aging myself, but
yeah,
it's the truth.
You always see Clint Howard as like, oh, there he's like in a Twilight Zone. Yeah. Like he just pops up and Land of the Lost too,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it seemed like at that time, television felt like there was a small community of actors that just sort of did everything.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. And, oh, my God, the Bridges brothers, I'd see them all the time when they were kids, and they were working with their dad and Lloyd, and, yeah, just nuts. I mean, there was a very small community of kids, you know, at the time.
Because your mom was on Perry Mason, right?
Yeah, Perry Mason, and in fact, they shot right here on this lot at one point.
Oh, here in Hollywood Center?
Mm-hmm.
This is a pretty historic lot. There was a lot of good. We're on the old I Love Lucy stage.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, this thing's been around for a long time. So you grew up, Now I feel like the idea of the entertainment business is so woven into pop culture now.
Right.
But at the time, it at least my perception was that it was a very separate lifestyle from just having a regular job and working like a 9-to-5 job. And I guess the internet sort of really tied everything together. So at the time, did you feel separated, or did you feel like, oh, what if I just lived in the Midwest and had a normal life?
Yeah, you know, growing up as a kid, you never know the difference because I had no perspective. I had nothing to compare it to. I mean, my parents were both working television actors, and their friends were, you know, Clint Eastwood and Jock Mahoney, who was a great stuntman here at the time, you know, and so people like that. But they would be at the house all the time. So I had no difference. I didn't know who these people were, you know. I was just running around in the valley at the time. The San Fernando Valley was all orange groves and dairy farms when I was growing up in the late 50s and the early 60s. So I didn't know anything.
And then then in the 70s, it all changed in the valley.
It all changed. Well, when they put the freeway over the hill there in the Sepulveda Pass. Sepulveda Pass, the 405. I mean, everything changed then, you know.
Let's get these buildings up as quickly as possible.
That's right.
It really does. Right. So much of Ventura Boulevard just feels like a rush job. They're like, guys, we have a week to get all these buildings up. Yeah. Doesn't matter
And it's just as ugly today as it was then.
Because it hasn't changed.
It hasn't changed at all. I mean, they're all just these things that are thrown up. And the government talks about infrastructure falling apart. Well, my God, most of the infrastructure here, the buildings haven't been touched in 50 years.
Oh, yeah. There was a really, my favorite sort of that's the valley story was after the 94 earthquake, there was a building off the 134 that where the roof was completely caved in, and you could just make out a sign on the side that said, like, contractor school. that pretty much tells you all you need to know about that part of the valley.
Yeah, yeah. Hands-on training right there. Demo first.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We made a breakaway roof.
Yeah.
So that, that's what everyone's doing now.
Yeah.
So then when you started becoming a teenager into your 20s and you started working on all these films, and then, well, actually, how was Carrie? How was the experience of Carrie? Did you have any idea? Did it feel like you were making one of the most important horror films?
Oh, God, no. No, at the time, I mean, I was a struggling actor doing a lot of theater. I started at South Coast Repertory down in Orange County, and I moved up here, and I was making rounds. Occasionally, I would work with Gordon Hunt when he was casting at the Taper, and he'd put me in things, you know, as understudies and sometimes feature roles. And I was just making the rounds as a kid. But when we did Carrie, I mean, they were doing the auditions. Him and George Lucas were doing the auditions at the same time. I mean, it's a famous story now, right? So we all walked in there, and I think they saw every young up-and-coming actor and actress at the time. And I got cast. It was, I don't think I read with anyone other than Amy Irving. Mm-hmm. And I think I did a scene with Sissy. I met John Travolta at the time in casting at Brian's. He had an apartment over on Fountain right off of La Cienega at the time. And we met. And a while later, we started, but nobody had any idea it was going to do anything. You know, we had heard of this guy, Brian De Palma, and there was rumor that this was going to be his breakout movie. I went and I saw Hi Mom and Greetings and some of the things he had done with Bobby De Niro and Tommy Smothers, you know, Get to Know Your Rabbit. And I thought he had a flair, but I thought he was pretty much, I knew him for the kind of dark comedies he had been done, that he had directed. But this was quite another thing, you know.
And did you feel it the second the movie came out? Did you feel like, oh, this is something different?
Well, I was living with two other guys, you know. I was in tenement housing. We were in a white ghetto area, and all of a sudden it was like I had all these girls would end up on my front lawn. I thought I'd died and gone to heaven, and my roommates were very happy. You know, I'm 24 years old. I mean, that was just heaven.
Oh, man, what a time. What a time to, you know, it's just, I mean, I know the 70s had its own b- bunch of political struggles, and it had its own. But it just sort of, I always think like, boy, would I love to go back and be in my mid 20s or early 20s in like the 60s, 70s, where everyone was just, there were no, it just felt like, yeah, there were no rules. Everyone was just fucking around and having fun.
Oh my God, it was crazy. And it was crazy. It was a good time. I had a lot of fun. I'm not going to get into the sort of details, but I had too much fun.
but you got it out of your system. You totally did get it out of your system. Did you feel like growing up that way? Was there a point where you sort of said, "Well, now, Bill, it's time to be mature and grow up and take this seriously"?
No. Maybe recently I felt like that. Certainly not during that time. And then we got around, you know, I did a lot of work. I still did a lot of work in the theater, so I was always traveling and doing that. And then Greatest American Hero came, and I had been, actually, I was off Broadway doing a play with Diana Wiest at the last season of the Phoenix Rep in New York. And we did a play called Bonjour la Bonjour, a Michel Tremblay play. And I went right, Steve Cannell came and he met me there, saw the play, we went to dinner, and I agreed to do the script. And my agent promised me it wasn't going to last more than 4 episodes. And came back to Los Angeles. My hair was brown at the time. I was playing a French Canadian. I dyed it back to my normal color because I'm naturally blonde, and it was curly at the time, naturally. And we did the show. Had a lot of fun, met Connie Selica, who wasn't going to be a regular on the show, who because the chemistry was so good, Steve made her a regular on the show. And we were off and running, Connie and Bob and myself.
Did they change your name in the show because it was the same last name as John Hinckley Jr.'s name? I feel like I remember seeing...
Was it the first season?
That there was, because originally it was Ralph Hinckley.
But then
there were a series of episodes where there was this really like...
I became Henley because of the assassination attempt on President Reagan.
Yeah, because John Hinckley Jr., so Hinckley became Henley. So there was just a lot of like VO of like, "Mr. Henley." Like you would just like kind of hear, like, "Should we just get the guy who originally said the line?" "Nah, fuck it, it's one word."
Yeah.
It's going to be fine.
But you know, I believe the truth of the matter is that Michael Paré came up with that name. He called me Mr. H.
Oh.
And when Cannell heard that, Steve and the producer, they said, "Ah, that's it, Mr. H."
That's it.
And that's how I was always addressed from thereafter.
I'd always hoped that they would take that story and make it a film. And I had heard that it was bouncing around for a while at like from studio to studio, but no one ever really had like a grasp on
it.
Oh,
in our comic book that was so short-lived, we did... I ended it on the belt buckle because I always was fascinated by that belt buckle. I thought it should do something.
Yeah.
So we made it like a Chinese puzzle box. And the last image in our comic book was that it was... A light was projecting, and it was coming apart. And I always wanted to use it as a portal. So I think there was a lot of things that they didn't get around to do. You know?
That's so much fun.
I know. But I read a very, very good script of The Greatest American Hero as a feature film, but it never got made.
Yeah, there were some storylines that like, well, there were a bunch of suits that got thrown all over the world, and then there was...
And Jack Black's name was thrown around to play the bad guy, and Alec Baldwin was touted to be the new Bill Maxwell.
Oh.
And, he would have been fantastic.
He would have been great.
And at the time, we talked about Owen Wilson, who is probably a little long in the tooth now, but... You know, 10 years ago, he would have been perfect, you know.
Oh, what's this suit, man? What is this suit? Oh, man, this fits great. Yeah, I don't know. That's my bad Owen Wilson. I was doing an improv show at the UCB Theater maybe like 4 or 5 years ago. And there was a guy in the front row, a distinguished older-looking gentleman. And in the back of my head, I said, "That's Robert Culp. I know that's Robert Culp." But I didn't want... He was sitting up front, laughing at the show, having a good time. And somehow he got engaged in the show. I can't remember how, but he got engaged. And so I was like, "What is your name?" And he goes, "My name is Robert. Robert Culp!" And I knew it! And he was so sweet. And I think his... I don't know if it was his daughter or his granddaughter. Someone was taking classes at UCB, so he came to a show.
Oh, cool.
And then and so I actually did get to meet him once, but just seemed like such a warm, lovely man.
I guess there was that aspect to him.
Maybe age settle them down.
No. Truth be told, I mean, you know, it's famous now. Bob and I were not the best of friends when we started our show together.
I did not know this.
And there was some real tension there on the set. But I think it lended itself to good chemistry, because in the show, we hated each other.
Well, that's a good attitude to have about it, because it sort of feels like, you know, like I always say this, that it's hard enough to get a job in this business, and then it's hard enough to get a job that's on, yeah. That goes.
Yeah.
And so when it's difficult, when people are being difficult, and there's like, it's like, this whole other layer of shit we have to go through just to even work.
Yeah. So I mean, that was going on, and that was always the subtext in the scenes, at least in the first two or three weeks of shooting. I mean, that subtext, like, can I cuss here?
Yeah. Okay. Can say whatever you want.
I hate that fucking dick. What a fucking prick. What a dick. But now let me qualify that, because then two or three weeks into it, we did arrive at a detente and a working relationship, and subsequent to that, grew to respect one another enormously and had a wonderful professional relationship, and then years later became quite good friends. And in the last years of his life, I mean, Bob and I, we would visit all the time, and he was a lovely, lovely guy. Very good to the people that he loved and his kids, and a lovely man.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad.
Whereas Connie Seliga, I mean, it was love at first sight.
Sure.
But she was taken with Gil already, and doggone it, I was married at the time.
Gil Gerard, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Wow, I had no idea. That's so funny. He seemed like, there was a little bit of What do you think it was? Do you think it was just sort of a grizzled old actor kind of?
Well, I think that, yeah, you look at I Spy or some of the other stuff he had done. I mean, this was who Bob was.
Yeah.
You know, just, and my God, no one could read a line like Bob Culp.
Right.
The way he would do line reading was just, I don't remember working with another actor that read a line like that.
How was your, so when you finally
uniquely complex, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
That's a really good way to put it. When you guys actually did your Comic-Con panel, what was the reception? How did it go?
Oh, my God. Well, Connie grabbed my arm as we were walking down the hall up on the second floor, and she said, God, do you think anyone will be there? And I said, I think so. And we walked into the room, and there was like 2,000 people sitting there.
Wow.
And it was just crazy. A wonderful reception. Chris Foligno arranged to tape Steve Cannell, who addressed the audience, gave a wonderful, warm welcome. And then we had Bob Culp was there, Connie was there, I was there, Dennis Matalone, who was our stunt coordinator and really created so much of the nuance that was people grew to love, the way he would hit the wall and all the stuff that we arrived at. He'd do these tremendous falls, and then I would pop up in the foreground, and people would think it was me. I'd be hiding behind boxes, and he'd hit the ground from 50 feet in the air, and he'd hit the ground right beside me, and then I'd pop up, and people would go, oh, my God, that's Bill Catt.
Well, I think with the way that pop culture has gone now, and I don't say this lightly because I don't normally think, oh, things should be rebooted. I feel like that storyline of the guy who gets a super suit and doesn't know how to use it, yeah, that's perfect. That is a perfect storyline for the stuff that people are into now. I would watch the shit out of that.
You know, I think Fox owned the rights. When Steven passed away a few years ago, I think he told me that the rights, Mike DeBelco, who was his partner in all of this, said that the rights were owned by 20th Century Fox. I'm not positive. Don't quote me on that. But I think his daughter is trying to relaunch it for television.
Oh, cool.
And I hope she gets it made, because it'd be fun to see back on the air. It's remarkable how it still holds up all these many years later. And it works on another level now, because being as an adult, you know, I didn't see the humor many, many years ago, but now I see this very kind of sophisticated adult humor that's running just behind the eyes, you know?
Yeah, it was a good buddy cop show, basically.
Yeah.
It was a good buddy cop show, and it's hilarious to me that to this day you could start singing the first few lines of the chorus of the song, and everyone in the room will chime in.
Yeah.
Even if some people aren't even sure, like, what the... They know, like, the song has... It's all just permeated culture.
It's great. And one of my biggest thrills is when Seth MacFarlane paid homage to it on Family Guy. You know, when Peter was being towed by the boat and he was singing the theme song. I mean, that was fantastic. I really like that.
So, you know, you sit when you say, like, you know, you've been working for a few decades in film and television. And what's your takeaway? Like, what have you learned all these years about, you know, like, can you kind of, for young performers or for young people who are just sort of like, what did you, when you first started out, what are your ideas about the way things work now versus when you first started?
I think there's more opportunity now than ever to become a breakout, in the same way that there's opportunities for gifted musicians, because you have access to the internet and you have a lot of content there with Hulu and some of the other content providers that are on the internet. There's a lot of cable stations out there. Cameras are much less expensive, sound and recording. I think there's a lot more opportunity, but in the same token, it's harder because there's so many more people trying to do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's only so much beachfront property, you know? there's only so many spots, you know, for actors. But if you got the goods and you're in the right place at the right time, I think you can find yourself in a very, very enviable position.
Did you always sneak away to do theater whenever you get away?
So much theater. Typically a play, at least one play a year, all my career. Just in the last few years, I've not done theater because I've been doing some other things. I'm working with Chris. I've been line producing and producing for Sideshow Productions, which is Chris Foligno's company. We do a lot of television commercials, and typically for like Jack Specific and Toys R Us and Konami. And Chris comes out of doing a gameplay. He worked at THQ. He ran their video division for many, many years. Very talented young guy, about your age probably, maybe a couple years older. But so I've been doing that, you know, putting budgets together and finding locations, take charge of the casting, help them get all that, and then write the checks and put out fires as the day goes on. And I've been doing that a lot, and I really enjoy that too.
Do you like, you know, if you like the theater... Do you like sort of being publicly anonymous in the sense that sometimes I think, you know, if someone's really, really famous and they do a play, then people are kind of going to see the fame instead of the play and the story.
Yeah.
So would you prefer to have complete anonymity when you're doing a play so people can really just kind of like buy you as the character or watch the story?
Yeah, I think that's the way it went before. You know, when I did Pippin with Fosse. I've gotten to work with great people. Fosse, John Frankenheimer. I've worked with Marsha Norman on stage, who won Pulitzer Prize for Night Mother. I've done world premieres of plays and things, but I never get those opportunities as an actor because I can be asked to reach further as an actor on stage because you have a little bit of that anonymity. Whereas in film and in television, you know, I always have that, oh, that's Bill Catt from Greatest American Hero.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what I do, it's that. Maybe a little bit different now because I'm getting older, I look a little bit different.
Is that, I mean, listen, I'm sure you appreciate it, but on some level, is it sort of like, but you know, I do stuff now. Like, is it sort of like, come on?
I'm at that point in my life. I think I've learned to embrace it. You know, where it's fine. I've done my thing. I've had my 15 minutes. I'm happy just to continue to work, and I get to meet great people like you guys.
Yeah. Hey.
You know.
Nice. And then this movie that.
Yeah. I did this. I mean, I still work. I did a number of films. Been working on this film with Chris Foligno and. With Clancy Brown and Clint Howard and Ashley Bell from The Last Exorcism. And, Jake Busey is in it, which was great working with Jake. I've known Jake since he was a little guy because I've been friendly with his dad, with Gary, for so many years since we did Big Wednesday many, many years ago. And so I got to work with all these great people. I have a film coming up called The Unwanted with a talented cast out of Atlanta. Hannah Fearman and some others. I did a wonderful film that's coming out along with Chris's film, Sparks, which is the name of the film that gets released in March 18th, I believe, is the release date for Sparks, or mid-March, but you can find it right around then.
I think it might be the 14th, because that's a Friday. Okay. 14th is a Friday.
And we're out in about 8 theaters, and it's growing all the time. We have more and more theaters that are, because the word of mouth has been very good for the film. We've had some wonderful feedback from people that have seen it, so we're going to be kind of all over the place. We're at the Roxy Stadium, we're at the Sierra Vista Cinemas, Lodi Stadium, LaMel and NoHo on March 15th, which is right here in North Hollywood.
Yep.
We're at the Alamo Drafthouse Cinemas in Houston in March. So we're it's getting a lot of buzz, a lot of word of mouth. So I'm hoping that people will come out and see it.
What's your favorite thing to do?
My favorite thing to do?
Yeah. Even if it's not entertainment related, like, what's your favorite thing?
Oh, my gosh. I don't know. I love to be with my... I love to play with my dog.
Oh, you do?
I love my dog.
What kind of dog do you have?
Cooper. Australian Shepherd.
They're the best.
He's my best friend. So I'm happy. With my wife, my dog, I'm happy to be... You know, I got 4 kids, great kids, and I hang with them, but they're all grown up now and on their way, and...
You know how when you're young and you start in the business, you're like, oh, it's the entertainment business is the most important thing, and I gotta do this, and I gotta work. You know, at what point do you start to go, you know, there's more to life and family and dog, and like, what point do you start to feel that? And so, is it a comfort you think that you get where you just get comfortable with yourself and you don't feel like, hey, I don't fucking have to impress everyone all the time. I can enjoy my life. I don't have to, you know, do a thing to be accepted.
Yeah. You know what happens is you lose that. You lose the love for it, for entertainment and whatnot, but you lose the hunger for it, you know? I'm not hungry for it anymore. I still enjoy it enormously to be on stage or to be in front of a camera, to solve the puzzle. You know, that was always my favorite part. Rehearsal was my favorite part of stage, because you get to solve the puzzle. How do you make this character work so that it becomes a... you can fill in all the puzzle parts and make him whole, and give him his sense of humanity, whether he's a good guy or a bad guy, fill in all the complexities that make him whole. I enjoy that part, but I don't have to do it anymore, you know?
Well, I feel like that's...
In fact, I don't have to be here anymore.
Wait, no, come back! Bill,
out of here.
Bill, please!
Okay.
And we never saw him again. Left his glasses, left his coffee, his pants. Theater always, like doing stage plays. I did them when I was in school, but the theater just thing freaks me out because I always felt trapped by it. That's why I love stand-up, because I can, turn on a dime if I need to or interact with the audience. But, you know, when you're in a scene, I feel like there's so much technically that you have to be doing as a stage actor. You have to be projecting, you have to be emoting in the right way, you have to connect with the audience without seeming like you're trying to connect with the audience, but then you're also stuck in it. Like, if it's not working, you're in it for 90 minutes.
Oh, yeah, and that's great. And it's great. Well, you know, doing stand-up and improv and whatnot, it's... Being on stage, it's such great training, and you can take what you learn there and put it in film, but it gives you the opportunity to go, okay, what are you doing if the prop is supposed to be there and you have a whole speech about this prop? What happens one night, and inevitably will, that prop is not there, or there's a set piece that's supposed to come out, and it doesn't come out. What do you do? Well, you have to make it up, you know, on the fly, and it's a lot of fun.
Do you have a favorite story of that?
There's so many that have gone on. I did a summer tour of oh my God, my mind just turned to mush.
I know that feeling. I get it often.
Music Man, right? And I was in front of 7,000 people at an open stage back in St. Louis. And I forgot the words of 76 trombones, right? I freaking went up. So I quickly ran down to the front of the stage, and I went, You all know the words. Come on.
That's a genius improv.
And everybody started singing. Whew, got out of that one. Or there was one time I was doing a speech in Michel Tremblay's play, Bonjour la Bonjour. I was on stage, and everyone is on stage all the time. And I went up on this speech, which was ran on for about 7 minutes, and it was all me talking. I had been sick. I had gone home at matinee, and I had, like, downed an entire bottle of Rubitussin, and I was delirious. So I went back for the evening performance, and I totally went up. And then I'm walking around to each actor asking for my lines, and they just folded their arms and smiled at me with this smug smile. So I just left the stage. I went over to the stage manager, who's on book, looked at the book, and walked back on stage and continued the play. Nobody ever knew.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that happens all the time. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. Are there any sort of cheats? Like, do you I feel like I would tape lines under things sort of like,
well,
just
I've done that.
Looking it up.
My favorite thing is working and breaking the fourth wall. As a stand-up, you get to talk to the audience and look right
into
their eyes.
There is no fourth wall, really.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So my favorite kind of play is to do it when we were doing a couple plays I've done, and you could break that fourth wall, and I'd walk right down into the stage. And one time I was at the Wolf Trap in Washington, in D.C., and I walked down there and I picked up one of my kids when they were a kid, and I did the whole scene with my kid, carrying my kid around as the Pirate King, you know? I was on tour with George Rose, you know. It was fun.
Have you ever... because those are my stress dreams. The stress dreams are like, you're on! What's the play?
Yeah.
You're supposed to know this! I don't... oh my God!
I know.
I'm having a heart attack.
It's crazy. Always for me since the time I've been a kid, I'm always at the theater 2 hours ahead of time, and I have to read the entire play every night from beginning to end.
Oh wow!
Quickly. I mean, I do it quickly, but I go through the whole play every night when I've been doing theater.
Just to keep it fresh.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What's your favorite kind of play to do?
I still love musicals, but I've done some really interesting dramas. The Days of Wine and Roses, I did with a wonderful actress, Maya Dillon. We did it at the Cleveland Playhouse. Jack Hofsis was the director. He won a Tony for Elephant Man years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we did the world premiere of the stage play of it, and that was one of my all-time favorites. I love doing Pippin. We did Pippin on Broadway with Cheetah Rivera and Ben Vereen. That was fantastic. I got to work with Randy Newman a few years ago in Seattle, with a stellar cast from Broadway, and we were doing his life story. We thought we were going back to New York, but we, for some reason or other, something political happened, and we didn't go to New York. But working with Randy Newman was like doing a master's class in music every single day, and we did that for 6 months. That was just fantastic.
What's the most important thing that a that a cast, any size cast, has to have in order for a play to work?
Oh, good Lord. I don't know.
Because it feels like there's, 10 different agendas going on, right? People are... It's 10 different characters. Let's say there's, 10 characters.
Yeah, you're always there to serve the author. Really, that's what you're there for as actors. You're there to serve the author and what that author wanted. And then, of course, then you have the director's vision and his interpretation of what the author was trying to say. And so you're all there serving another master.
Yeah.
So
it's because it feels to me like it's a dynamic that on one side of the coin has to be selfish, but on the other side of the coin has to be the opposite of selfish, because you're a part of a group. And this whole idea of serving the author wasn't even anything that I had thought of yet. So it feels like, I don't know, it just feels like there's, my brain can't wrap around it in a way that I feel comfortable with.
Yeah, and then again, when you're doing, whether you're doing film or television or theater, you have to know what scenes are yours and what scenes are your fellow actors. And you have to go, okay, this is your scene. You take it. And I will just hit the ball back to you nice and easy so that you can just hit it out of the park.
Yeah.
And that's when you talk about actors being generous and gracious. Giving actors, they talk about that. Those are actors that know how to do that.
Yeah.
I will give you that scene. I will give you this. This is yours. Take it.
Do any of your kids act?
No, none of my kids act.
Was there ever...
No. I pulled out a bullwhip and I whipped them.
This is a headshot. Don't ever get one of these. So they all just...
They never show that interest. And, you know, we kind of grew up a little bit on the outskirts of Los Angeles. So there was never that interest, really. And if anyone had wanted to, you know, it was always, go get it.
Yeah.
You know, when I was 12, I was on my bike to go get one of my first times I met with an agent. I rode my bike, my little 20-incher, up to meet an agent, you know, because I was interested.
It was probably much safer then.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. That's true.
So what are the other things that you're working on now besides Sparks?
Well, Sparks is, you know, we've been working on this for quite some time now. We shot it, just a little bit of the genesis of it. Sparks came as I said earlier, it was an original comic book mm-hmm. idea. We did five or six issues. There is a full-length graphic novel now that goes out with this movie. We're going to be in Diamond with that graphic novel, and it's going to be in support of the film. It was a brainchild of Chris Foligno's. It was about... the story is a superhero noir thriller set in the 1940s. It's a story of a masked vigilante, Ian Sparks, who discovers the dark side of heroism, and he goes after the nation's most notorious super criminals, leaving Sparks' life and reputation in ruins. Did I read that right?
What? That was all from memory. What are you talking about? As a matter of fact, not only was it from memory, but you can't see, but Bill just took his glasses off and looked up at the sky.
Yes.
And almost the words...
Yes.
Just like they said about Mozart, it's like he was dictating the words of the angels.
That's all
it was.
we did that. We shot it in 12 days, two crews running from one set to the other.
12 days?
12 days.
Holy
insane.
Shit.
Two full crews.
Do you like that kind of schedule or do you just
No. Well, the horrible part about that was that it was all nights in the middle of January. So it was freezing out, and we were working every night from like 6 in the evening to 6 in the morning. And it was raining all the time, and it was just some incredible nastiness. And but we managed to do it, and then we spent the next year doing visual effects in between commercials and things that Chris was doing. And two guys did 450 CG shots.
Oh, shit.
I mean, so it was typically you go see one of these, you know, studio films, then you'll see like for a minute and a half, they'll list all these guys doing the visual effects. But in this case, it was only two guys. Yeah.
Do you like producing?
I do. Yeah, I really, really do. I like saying you're fired because I've heard it so many times.
that's when it all comes back around.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I always feel like most performers kind of, you know, there's a list in the back of your head where you're just like, all right, that guy was kind of a dick.
Yeah.
Just wait. We
call them in just in order to I say, come on in, we're doing this part, and then they come in, they go, nah, I don't know, I think we're going another direction. You know,
the direction being that you're a dick.
You're a dick.
And no, I mean, I always you know, is I mean, look, anyone's professional career, especially in this business, is you really have to become friends with rejection, or at least figure out how to tolerate. Rejection really is everyone's Robert Culp in season one of Greatest American Hero.
Yeah.
And so you really have to learn how to have a good working relationship with it. You know, like, how do you... I mean, there are some people who are just naturally predisposed to understanding, like, I'm going to not get knocked down, I'm going to get back up, and that's fine. But, you know, but really trying to impart to people, look, you cannot succeed unless you fail a bunch first.
Oh, my God.
That's when all the learning happens.
Doing stand-up, you got to realize that. And any writer who's worth his salt, I mean, how many rejection letters have all these great writers gotten before they sell that first novel and they have that first hit? The same thing with stand-up. How many times have you gone out there and it's just like death in the audience?
But I love, the thing that I prefer about to stand-up over like auditioning is that
if the rejection is going to happen, it's immediate, and I know, and there's no waiting.
Yeah.
Waiting is the worst part. Like, the waiting and the hoping and the, you know, it's because it starts to, as I'm sure you know, it kind of does this thing to you where you never get too excited or too upset about anything, mm-hmm. which is sort of, you know, kind of robs you a little bit of your experiences.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's the one way that you can just, that you don't go crazy. It's just by not allowing yourself to go like, oh, this is the greatest day in the world. Oh my God, what happened? What am I doing? Hey, everything's great again. Yeah, what the fuck is happening?
Yeah, yeah. And you can't take the Zoloft or Prozac or anything because that that deadens that edge that you have as an actor. So you can't do that.
It doesn't stop people from doing it, but they shouldn't do it. Yeah. It is. I always say that... you know, that this business attracts a certain very insecure personality type, but it's the worst business for that personality type because it just, you constantly get kicked in the teeth for years and years and years.
Yeah, yeah.
So what was it about you? Well, I guess that's one of the nice things about always having theater is that no matter where the highs and lows in television are, it's like, oh, I can just go do a play, and at least I can go do, you know, I can do something that I love.
Well, any play worth its salt, I mean, there's the audition process as well, you know. I mean, it's very similar, but the process of a theater audition is different. I don't know, I mean, because typically when you walk on stage, a director will work with you. And they say, okay, well, let's take that back a little bit. And think about this. I want you to have bear this in mind when you go through that speech again. And that's typically what will happen on stage. Whereas here, you walk into a room and you're auditioning for a television show, say. It's typically, they have a video camera and they tape you saying it with two or three other people sitting behind the camera and you get one shot at it. And that's it. You know,
and then they go, oh, we gave it to someone more famous. What again? Come on, I worked on this.
Yeah,
it is. But I almost think that it's a good, I never appreciated it when I was younger, but I really do think now that the sort of the cutthroat trial by fire of that process means that only the people that are the most committed are really gonna get through.
Yeah, possibly. And then, you know, I've been now for so many years, I've been behind on the other side doing the auditions.
Yeah.
And having actors come in and audition. And I see a whole other side to it and why people are cast for certain roles. And a lot of times it's not at all what they think, you know.
No, but
why they didn't get something.
You build a story in your head.
And oftentimes the best people, the best actors, the most talented, don't get the role for various other reasons.
Right. Well, it's... You know, because we have no, there's no manual or there's no like, well, it's for this and this and this reason. Like most of the time, you don't even know.
Yeah.
So whatever kind of emotional baggage you have, that's probably going to be there. Oh, I'm not good enough again. Like, yeah. No, they went with an Asian guy. What do you want? You know.
Well, that's what they say when you go and you do the audition. Just go in and give it your best shot.
Yeah.
And you really have no control over the outcome.
That's the hardest thing to, not just with auditioning, but with anything, is really learning. Were you kind of a control freak growing up, or are you kind whatever happens is cool?
Yeah, I grew up surfing. I mean,
oh yeah, you know, okay, there you go.
So I was pretty, you know, pretty chill about everything.
What was the surf scene like when you were surfing?
Oh, it's, you know, it was great. It was crowded then. I stopped in the, you know, like late 70s, I really put my boards away and whatnot and stopped because I was working so much and spent so much time away from the beach by then. But it was great growing up. I was surfing in the later part of the 60s and most of the 70s. It was great.
I mean,
I loved it. I was there at the advent when they made the switch from longboards to shortboards.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And do you ever entertain the idea now? Well, I mean, it might be fun to go out and get on a board or like do a little wakeboard.
I still have a couple of boards in my garage, you know, but I don't have the access to the, you know, the beaches are too crowded. Malibu's always too crowded and you don't want to get out there and, you know, have people like, hey, my wave, get on it. You know, I can't do that anymore.
Now it seems like the way that people do everything is so extreme. It's like, if you're going to do it, you have to surf like this. The craziest, get through the fucking wickedest putt, you know. I don't know. It's like now everything is, everything, our culture seems so much about like, You know, it's cool if it can become a YouTube video and you get punched in the balls, you know, as opposed to just, I don't know, back then it just sort of seemed like, oh, this is part of the beach party, and we'll have a bonfire and listen to the fucking Beach Boys or Dick Dale and, you know, hop on a board.
Yeah, it's always, well, nowadays it's about how do you one-up the next person? How do you make a better video?
Yeah.
Something that's going to get more play on YouTube, you know, and that's what it's all about these days.
Do you know the answer to that? Because I really want to know the answer to that. Can you tell me how that works, please? Because we're trying. It is interesting. It is interesting that we are all that, you know, not in a bad way, but everyone is really all in competition with one another now when it comes to that sort of thing. In the way that you said, I tend to use that as positive motivation. Like, oh, I don't want to bury anyone else, but how do I up my game? You know, but it's so crazily competitive now.
How have you, this podcast goes out to quite a few people. Your audience has grown and grown and grown. How have you accomplished that?
Because we had the Greatest American Hero on.
Right.
I don't know. We just, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I feel like I tried so hard to fit in with the rest of the business for so long. And then when I started just doing things that I liked because I liked them, then that's when things started working.
I wondered why this wasn't videotaped, you know, but then when I see all you guys sitting here naked, then I understand.
Yeah. Well, we feel like it makes everyone more comfortable.
Yeah.
Because then, you know, like if you come in and we're not wearing clothes.
Well, it's immediately funny when you walk through the door and you see it, you go, oh, well, this is going to be different.
You know, someday. Yeah. Well, we'll have to just do that when it's Matt and Jonah, just as a joke. And when Katie's not here, because that would be sexual harassment. But if it's just the dudes, it'd be totally cool.
Ball party.
Yeah.
Ball party.
So what are you up to the rest of the day? We're almost done. What are you up to of the day? Yeah, that was almost an hour, man.
Wow, very cool.
What are you up to?
Quickly, people should look for The Unwanted, which is a great film coming out later in the year, and Subterranea, which is two other films I have besides Sparks. But Sparks is pretty cool. I think people are going to really dig it. It's a very interesting film. It's well shot, beautiful score, and I think people will be really, really surprised.
Are you a sci-fi fan? Do you like sci-fi?
I do like sci-fi. I like everything. Just anything that's engaging. A good story is really fine for me.
If you're home and you're flipping channels and you see a movie's on, what movie do you go, oh, I'm in now. I gotta sit and watch this.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I like World War Z, and I like a lot of sci-fi, and I also like films that are dramas and good comedies. I'm a fan of them all. You know, just a good story.
Are you guys going to produce another movie after this one?
We've been tossing around a couple ideas, but we're broke right now, so we're waiting.
Well, that's what, you know, like if you spend so much time working on one thing, it's sort of like, oh, here's the, you know, we're going to gamble in on this one. Let's hope it all works.
But Chris Foligno's got some great ideas, and I have a few ideas myself, and so we're tossing those around, and we'll see what happens in the next few months.
Excellent. Oh, I just remembered... You did a whole version of the Perry Mason series.
I did.
Didn't you?
I did.
But Raymond Burr was long dead by that point.
No. Raymond Burr was still alive.
Oh, he wasn't it?
I did the first 4 or 5 years of the Perry Mason specials.
Right.
With my mom, Barbara Hale.
Yes.
Who played Della Street. And I worked with her for 4 or 5 years. And then they went on. Billy Moses took my role and created when I left the show to go to Top of the Hill for Cannell again.
Yeah.
In 89, he took over and they did another 4 or 5 years. They did like 23 or 24 two-hour movies.
Wow.
And he died the last two or they did 3 or 4 without him. He had passed on.
I don't know. You know, even as a kid, for whatever reason, when that opening Perry Mason theme song would come on.
Da 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 da.
Yeah. It's just the empty court. It's just dark and creepy and weird. And I don't know. It felt to me like it was going to be sci-fi, but it was never sci-fi.
Talk about a rumor. There's rumor that Robert Downey is recreating that role of Perry Mason.
Are you serious?
Yeah. And he'd be...
What?
Yeah.
He's going to self-financing a bunch of it?
To do as a TV show or as a film?
No, as a movie.
A Perry Mason movie series. Yeah.
But he'd be great in the role. He kind of looks like a young Raymond Burr.
Well, he does.
He's smart, He's funny. I think he's just perfect casting.
Yeah, that's really. How did I miss that?
I don't know.
That's crazy. Because I always wonder, like, so what is the value? What is the value? Like, what can you bring to? So much of Perry Mason was just Raymond Burr. So how do you do that without him?
RDJ.
I guess if you can make him Sherlock, you can pretty much make him. If you could make an American Sherlock, then I guess the guy can pretty much fucking do whatever he wants.
He can do whatever he wants.
Yeah. Even if it's a flop, he'll be fine. Even if it's a flop, you know, if he's making the movie and at the end they realize, you know what, this is a flop, then he can just put on the Iron Man suit and just fly through the screen at the end and people will be like, okay, I'm on board. It's totally fine.
Well, thanks, man. Hey, I've really enjoyed this. Thanks, you guys.
Oh, my God. Oh, William Catt, it is a pleasure. And again, I mean, I really tried not to scare you too much at how much of a Greatest American Hero fan I am. But I really did, like 10 years ago, I bought this like red unitard and I ironed on the pattern and hand painted it and made the belt out of foam core and
put the
red. I'm going to keep talking about it until you get creeped out and put the red piping along the cape.
I'm already creeped out.
Even as a kid, there was one episode where the aliens came back, they gave you the manual again, and it seemed like he's finally going to figure it out. And then you shrink down and you leave it in granules of sand.
Yes.
And as a child, I was heartbroken because I felt like I had lost the manual for the second time. And in my adult years, I understand that you need the conflict of not having the manual.
Yeah.
But God damn it.
I know.
It all worked out fine, though, right? Just tell me, in the fan fiction universe, it all worked out fine, right?
Yes.
Okay, good.
We're all good.
Okay, good. Thanks, man,
for having me on.
It was a pleasure to meet you.
Yeah.
William Catt.
Bye, you guys.
That was Kyle.
Cheers.
That was Katie. Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Bye, everybody out there.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Hover.com. Hover is the best way to buy and manage domain names. For 10% off your new domain name, use the promo code BRUCEGUTTER.